Welcome to the Hobby of a Lifestyle podcast, a show that looks at how our passions impact lives and drive career choices. I'm Andy Gray, a former national and world champion kickboxer. During my shows, I'll be talking with athletes, coaches, fans and more as I delve into their world to find out what inspired them on their journey. Have I got a great guest for you this week? For those joining me for the first time, welcome to Hobby of a Lifestyle. For my regular listeners, welcome back. I am joined by Adriana Brownlee. She is current Guinness World Record holder for being the youngest female to ever summit K2 and is embarking on a mammoth challenge to complete all 14 peaks over 8,000 metres around the globe. She's already completed 10 and is on quite a remarkable journey. Let's find out the whole story. Adriana, welcome to Hobby of a Lifestyle. How are you today?
I'm great, and thank you for having me today.
Oh, no, the pleasure is all mine. I'm so excited to learn about your journey. Adriana, do you just want to tell people that listen to the podcast exactly what your passion is, what you are probably best known for?
Yes, so I am a 21-year-old mountaineer and adventure athlete. And so I'm currently on a project to climb all the 14 8,000 meter peaks and hopefully be the first British woman ever and the youngest female ever to do so. So it's a pretty big project.
It's a huge, I mean, 21 years old. The current record's 30 years old and 166 yes. days, is that right?
Yep.
So yeah, I did a little bit of research, just a little bit. And the aim is to achieve it by 23 years old?
No, hopefully 22.
Oh, wow.
So my plan is to finish by next summer. Wow. So I've got one winter expedition coming up, hence why I'm in Nepal at the moment. And that'll begin in 4 days.
Oh, really?
And then I'll have three more next year. And then hopefully the project's over and I can move on to bigger, more exciting things.
I don't think it get bigger. Certainly not in terms of height. People might be sitting listening thinking, at 22 years old, how are you going to complete all 14 peaks that are over 8,000 meters high? You've already done 7. Is that right?
10.
10 now. Oh my, obviously the website needs updated. The website needs updated.
Yes, so you've it does. 10. I'm really bad at that.
Don't worry, I'm shocking. So you've already done 10 at 21. Right, before we even talk about those, let's quickly go back to your childhood. Kind of, where did you grow up and what were you into as a child?
So I was born and raised in South London. And it's just me and my parents.
So many mountains in South London.
Yeah. Yeah. Vast, beautiful landscapes. There wasn't any mountains there. But my dad was into mountaineering, but more as a hobby, and more just in and around the UK. So when I was 8 years old, my father had already been chatting about, you know, climbing Aconcagua, which is the highest mountain in South America, like as part of his plans.
Right.
So I kind of had this seed sown in my head from when I was very small. And I was sat in my primary school classroom and the teacher asked us to write down, like as a homework, to type up what we want to do when we're older.
Right.
And so, like, I was wondering in my 8-year-old head what I want to do. And I think most kids probably would have wrote, like, ballerina, footballer,
Superman.
Yeah, the usual, astronauts, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And I ended up writing that I want to climb Everest and that I want to inspire other people to do the same. So then fast forward 12 years later, I achieved that.
Wow.
And yeah, I guess I'm one of those rare cases where I actually did what I dreamed of when I was a child.
100%.
And, stuck at it.
You know, so you've wrote that down as an 8-year-old child. And let's be honest, we've just said there's no mountains really. Not even in England, not even in the UK or kind of, you know, anything major. So how did you go about starting to put these plans into place? Obviously, you've got a very supportive family there, and the fact that your father wanted to go to South America to do something similar, you obviously got that, you know, that nice progression there. But how do you even start to get into that? And you know, when you see your friends out, I'm going to hike and I'm going climbing, what are they thinking? You know, because they want to be ballerinas, they want to be footballers.
Yeah, so actually when I was 9, so the year later, My dad suggested that we do the Three Peaks Challenge.
Yeah.
So that's the highest mountain in England, Scotland, Wales. And the aim is to do it in under 24 hours.
Now I've done that one. I've done that one, I must admit. Yeah. But I wasn't 9 years old when I did it.
Yeah, so we did do it. And then so the first time we tried it, and we did Snowdon first, then Scafell, then the plan was to do Ben Nevis after. Yeah. But by the time I got to Ben Nevis, I was throwing up everywhere from car sickness. And then we got to about 200 meters below the summit, and I got hypothermia.
Oh, no.
And I couldn't, you know, reverse it. And I was putting on layer after layer, yeah, and people were stopping on the way. Like, what is wrong with this girl? And why is she even here? And then my dad, like, he asked me, and before he asked me this question, he already knew the answer that it should have been. And he asked me, look, either we can push on,
yeah,
or we can go back home and we can try again another time. And like, you know, when you're young, like, you don't want to give up on things, yeah, and you get upset easily. So I started obviously crying my eyes out. And then I said, okay, let's go back and we try again in 2 weeks.
Wow.
So we made our merry way back to London, and 2 weeks later we did it, and we did it in 22 hours. So that was great. And I think my dad just went through a few speed cameras to do that. But
it's really okay. Hard, isn't it?
God,
it's the driving that's the hardest part.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
I agree. Totally agree. Not as a 9 year old, I can't agree, because I wouldn't even be. Yeah, definitely not. It's amazing.
But yeah, so that was kind of like the first step.
Yeah, yeah.
And then from that, I knew that this was, you know, igniting a light bulb in my mind, and that this was kind of what I was supposed to do, these endurance events.
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't know about climbing 8,000 meter peaks really, but I knew that I was going to do, you know, something like this in my future. So my dad did go on to climb Aconcagua a few years later, and I was in awe. I just thought my dad was like the most amazing person in the universe. And I tell my friends, I'm like, my dad just climbed Aconcagua. They're like, oh, what?
Like, yeah, what's that?
English, please. Like, they just obviously they didn't care.
Yeah.
But then I was like, okay, I want to climb Aconcagua. So then at 15 years old, we made a plan to try and do the Seven Summits together, sort of as a father-daughter thing.
Wow.
Because I don't think there are any father-daughters that have done it, as far as I'm aware.
Yeah, yeah.
So we started with Kilimanjaro.
Wow.
Then we went to Elbrus, and then we did Aconcagua. So during this time, I sacrificed my prom, my GCSE studies. So I was studying on Kili at 5,000 meters.
Sounds horrible.
And then my 18th birthday was on the summit of Aconcagua. Wow. So for me, they were all very special, but for the other my friends, I just thought, like, a weirdo giving up all these big things, you know, in your adolescent life.
I think it's one of those things that people don't appreciate unless they're an elite athlete or a performer or whatever it is they're doing. Yeah, and I think that's one of the main reasons behind this podcast as well, is to highlight the sacrifices that people like yourself make in order to achieve dreams and pursue goals. You know, I'm assuming you completed your GCSEs.
Yes.
Did you go on to A-levels as well?
Yes.
Wow. And did you go on to uni?
Yeah, I did for 4 months.
So I'm kind of thinking with your journey that you've been on, uni doesn't sound like there's really ever going to be an option, because you seem to be gallivanting off around the world doing these amazing challenges. But again, that's a sacrifice that you've made. You've kind of put that period of your life on pause, I suppose, in order to go and pursue this goal, which is, let's be honest, is mega. But, you know, sacrificing the prom and seeing that your friends don't understand at the end of the day, you had a bigger goal than going to a prom, and it's one night out of the rest of your life to achieve these goals, which is just absolutely phenomenal. I mean, like you say, spending your 18th birthday on top of a mountain is like, wow. And again, do that with your dad as well. I mean, what's your mother thinking when you two are off doing this?
At the beginning, we did Aconcagua. That was amazing. And then the next plan was to do Everest.
Yeah, yeah.
Because that's part of the Seven Summits. So I actually took a gap year after my A-levels in order to do Everest. But then COVID started.
Yeah, yeah.
So then all of that got cancelled and put on hold for 2 years. And then when I eventually had the freedom to travel, instead of going to Everest, I actually went to K2 Winter Expedition.
Right.
With Nims Dai and his team of 9 Sherpas. And their plan was to be the first ever Nepali team to summit an 8,000er in winter. And K2 had never been climbed in winter.
Wow.
So my purpose was just to like do training there hang out with the Sherpas and get to know the team. And then after that, we were going to go straight to Nepal and do Everest.
Wow.
So when I went to this K2 Winter Expedition, I went to Camp 1, came back down. And then Nims actually came to me. He was like, you need to do the 14 8,000ers. I was like, okay. He was like, this is like what you're meant to do. And you're super strong here. And I think you can do it.
Wow.
And he was like, do it over like 5 years or something. And I was like, no, I want to do it in like 1 or 2 years. Like I want to, you know, make it worth it. Because he just finished his 6-month 14 Peaks project.
So
I wanted to follow in those footsteps. So I called my mom straight away. And I told her, I was like, look, I'm not coming back. I'm just going to go. I'm going to do Everest. I'm going to do the rest of the 14.
Wow.
And she was like, you were supposed to be a doctor. Like, how did you go from that to now wanting to sacrifice everything, give up uni, give up your life to climb? And I was like, trust me, like, trust the process.
Yeah.
I will fund all the rest of my mountains. Like, my parents said they would fund Everest because it was my dream from so young. And they were like, it was always in our plan anyway. So they said, we'll fund that. And then the rest is for you to do.
Wow. I mean, talk about the funding there, sorry, Adriana, just to kind of put in, because I've met a gentleman before who kind of got to the base camp for Everest, but unfortunately just due to avalanches and whatnot, it was scrapped. It was a few years ago now. And he was telling us about the cost that of kind of summiting Everest. I kind of, without giving a specific figure, but do you want to kind of let people know how much that dream costs?
Yeah, so Everest itself can range from about $35,000 USD up to $350,000 USD,
wow.
Depending on who you climb with.
Of course.
If you're climbing with Nims Dai, it's $350,000 to $500,000.
Wow.
But my expedition company that I climb with can charge $35,000, and it's still the same base camp infrastructure, the same quality of Sherpa. It's just you're paying for the name. It's like a designer brand kind of thing. But yeah, it's very expensive. So this whole project will be nearing $1 million for sure.
It would have been cheaper to go to uni.
I know.
Do you know what it is, though? But you wouldn't have the same satisfaction. But I think it's really important that we talk about, you know, obviously you've been very fortunate that your parents were in a position that could fund that dream for Everest.
Exactly. Yeah.
But after that, it's all about you and the hard work that you're putting in and branding yourself as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, again, it's just highlighting the people, the sacrifices that people have to make and the cost that kind of that people don't see. They see the glory at the end of it, they don't see the hard work you've put in to be there.
I mean, the most common message I get, for example, on social media or even in person, is, oh, so your parents pay for all of this. I'm like, no. Like, I think trying to fund this project is harder than any climb I've ever done.
I can imagine.
And I guess obviously people make assumptions. I come from a good family. I come from a good place, and they just hear my voice and they think, just daddy's paid for everything.
Yeah.
And I was like, it drives me insane because I go home and all I'm doing is working my ass off, like 13, 14 hours a day, emailing sponsors, doing interviews, doing podcasts, you know, doing talks, motivational speaking all over the UK and the world. And preparing for that. So yeah, there's a lot of work that goes into trying to make these work, but it's worth it in the end.
100%. What does a training camp look like? How do you even begin to train for something like what you're doing?
Well, it depends. So I trained for Everest for almost 4 years solid. Before I'd even planned it.
Wow.
And I just love training anyway. Yeah. So it wasn't, you know, hard for me to get into that rhythm, but I would do around 2 hours of cardio and an hour of weights a day, 6 days a week. Very intense. And I also did taekwondo, it was my other hobby. So I did that for 9 years, almost 10. Wow. So a combination of all of this is what kind of got me fit and ready to do Everest. And when do Everest, I was by far the fittest in my group, because I just knew, I was like, I want to be able to run a marathon on that summit. Like, that's how healthy and fit I want to be. And it pays off.
How do you begin to train for the altitude training, though? You know, being in England, it's not really something that you can do unless you, you kind of put measures in place, or you go and visit special kind of facilities. So how do you go? What's that like when you first start getting into that altitude training?
Well, before I didn't really do any altitude training. Right. So I went to Aconcagua, which is 6,900 meters.
Right.
And that was a good indicator of how well my body adapts to how well it acclimatizes.
Yeah.
And as soon as I knew that, you know, actually it does acclimatize pretty well and I have quite good genetics in that way, then I was kind of just ready to go. And all I had to do was train at home at sea level and acclimatize properly on the mountain when I get there, because you have so much time to acclimatize. But now that I've been, you know, doing all these mountains, I've been invited to train at the Altitude Center in London, which is an amazing facility. It's got so like a pod room, which is set to 2,700 meters constantly. And you do like your normal training in there. So, you know, treadmill running or cycling or even a circuit.
Wow.
And it doesn't acclimatize you, but it makes your lungs work harder. And over time, it decreases your VO2 max. It's a nice training thing to have, and it's close to home. Other than that, I just train at sea level and make sure that I feel good on the mountain by taking it real slow. And
that's phenomenal. Wow. I mean, I'm kind of listening to that there. My mind's working at a million miles an hour with different questions. And then I kind of go, I'm going to ask one and I forget. Oh, no, I'll come back to that one. But I think the one that's really sticking out to me is Everest was always the dream. You achieved that. Now, it seems as though very early on you've replaced the Everest dream with the 14 peaks.
Yeah.
But I'm imagining with Everest seems to be the pinnacle. It's, you know, with it being the highest, it's the pinnacle. How do you stay motivated after you've completed your dream? Or was it genuinely just because you've replaced that dream with something different?
Yeah, I think so. Because that 14 dream came before I actually summited Everest. Yeah. So I knew as soon as I came off Everest, I was going to bounce onto the next 8,000er. And that's what keeps me going, is knowing that there's another one coming after. And, you know, that's not the end, because I do see it. So I see it a lot in people where they climb Everest. That was all they were planning. They go home and they just have this massive down, because like, what do you do now? You know, and there's nothing after. And I mean, luckily I don't have a job or anything, so I can just do this continuously. Like, this is my job. It's my career. So, but yeah, it's just having that next goal in mind. But I mean, it kind of translates into life anyway. As soon as you have a goal, that keeps you motivated and, you know, in line, on track. Even like if you go to the gym, for example, if you don't have a goal in mind, like weight loss goal or muscular hypertrophy goal, then you're not going to be motivated to train, especially when it's really hard and it gets tough. You're just going to think, well, why am I actually doing this? You know? It's the same as in the mountains. You just got to have that next plan.
How do you keep yourself motivated? Because let's be honest, what you're doing isn't easy. And there must be times when you're up on a mountain where you just think, what am I doing this? It'd be so easy to bail out now. For a 21-year-old to be, and I know a lot of professional athletes are so very, very driven, but it's a very different mindset. And it's one that if you could kind of bottle and sell, you'd be a millionaire. And how do you stay motivated in those moments? Because although you might be doing it with a team, it's a very much an individual challenge.
I mean, it's a good question, because genuinely, I don't know. I think I was kind of just born with this mindset, honest. And I've also had it in my family. My dad's exactly the same as me. He's one of those sort of stubborn and extremely determined people that once he's, you know, doing a project or doing some sort of event, his mind is just laser focused. So when it does get tough, you know, a big part of it is having a nice team around you. And my climbing partner is also my life partner. So we have a very good bond. and we can just communicate with each other and egg each other on. We have the same project. So he's only one away from completing his 14. Wow. And I'm four away. So we're kind of on the same track, and it's nice to have that because it is quite a lonely place. But
and will he rub it in when he completes it before you?
Yeah, he'll finish in winter. He'll finish this winter. So
have you not finished yet? Have you not finished?
I know. But maybe he'll do double 14.
Amazing. You never know. Wow. I mean, because I think when you see the likes of the documentaries that are on the Netflixes and the Disneys of the world, and you hear about documentaries, you hear a lot of the horror stories about things that can happen to people on these mountains, and because they sell, they make really good stories. But I mean, what's some of the worst things that you've seen up on a mountain?
I mean, I've seen a lot of death, a lot of tragedies and avalanches, I mean, it's not nice to see. You kind of question, like, why am I doing this? Obviously, but also to myself, I've had a few, you know, horror stories on Dalagiri, which was my third 8,000er last in 2021.
Right.
So I was climbing with a different climbing partner who I'd never climbed with before. I didn't really have much trust, because, you know, we'd never done anything, so I didn't know, like, who he really was. So I mean, we started off, it was all wonderful until we got to camp two, and the plan was to actually summit straight from camp two. So camp two is almost 6,500, and summit is eight, I can't remember exactly. So anyway, that's a very big summit push and not recommended. And we were a team of five in total.
Right.
And the rest of the teams had gone home because the weather was so bad.
Wow.
And there was a big weather warning coming in, and we just decided to ignore it, as you do. So, yeah, we set off from camp two. It was beautiful, like stars in the sky. So wonderful. It was like 12 p.m. at this time. And then like 1 hour later, suddenly the weather just completely flipped. And it went from 0 kilometers per hour to like 80 kilometers per hour wind. Wow. And this wind with my height means I can't move.
Right.
I am holding onto this rope for dear life, and this wind is blowing me away. And because I was holding on and I didn't have proper gloves on, my hands completely froze solid. For the first time in my life, I was like, I'm going to lose my hands.
Really?
And like as soon as you get this thought, you're just thinking like it's a spiral of negativity. You're like, I'm gonna lose my hands, I can't climb anymore, I'm gonna be in hospital. And like this spiral just sends you into chaos. And I didn't know what to do, and my mind was gone. And then the leader behind me, he just turned me around and he was like, Adri, like, you have to get down now, or otherwise you're gonna lose your hands. And so like I had to put my hands in his armpits for them to warm up, which was disgusting, but the nerve sensations started coming back, and it's probably the most excruciating pain
you
could ever feel, because most of those nerve endings are now damaged.
Really?
So even now, like, feeling very hot or very cold things is, you know, it doesn't feel right. It's slightly painful and sensitive, very sensitive. But that's what saved them. So we got down to camp two, and there was all five of us in one tent. Yeah, the tent had blown away. And we had to stay there for 5 nights at 6.5 meters, waiting for a weather window to go back up again. So we ran out of battery packs. We ran out of food. Like, we had nothing. I had no tracker. So usually I wear a tracker that my parents watch as I go up. So this completely ran out of battery. But anyway, we're like, okay, we're going to do this because this mountain is awful and we just want to do it and get it done. So we went for our summit push, and it took 16 hours to reach the summit.
Wow.
Going through snow, like waist deep, really hard, really difficult, but we reached the summit. And then I started to feel like really lightheaded, and I was like, this is a bit weird because I'm on oxygen, so I shouldn't feel like this all of a sudden. So I asked my Sherpa guide, I was like, can you check my oxygen? Like, something's not right. And he was like, oh, it's run out. I'm like, what do you mean it's run out? And I was like, well, do you have oxygen? He's like, no, mine's also run out. And I was like, we're at 8,000 meters here. Like, if you run out of oxygen, your body like goes into panic because it's been relying on it for the past 16 hours and you're in the death zone now, which means if you don't have oxygen, you're dying by the minute.
Wow.
And I was like, again, total chaos mentally. And I just sat down on the summit and I was like, okay, if we don't start going down now, that's it. Game over. I'm dead. And he's dead. And to add to that, we didn't have a radio with us and we were the last ones on the summit. So we had no contact with anyone. We had no oxygen, no tracker. My parents were obviously at home.
Yeah, of course.
You know, on the edge of their seats, shitting themselves, like thinking I was dead. Anyway, I was like, you know what? If we don't get down, that's it. So I'm going to get down. So we pushed each other down all the way to Camp 3, where we found a radio, had contact with our leader, Nims. And we're like, look, we have no oxygen. Like, we're at a okay altitude now. We can get down without. But we might have to sleep one night at Camp 2 or Camp 1 because we're wrecked. And he was like, I'm sorry, but we have to be down by 5 a.m. at base camp. You're joking, like all the way down to base camp from summit.
What was the reason you had to be down by 5 a.m.? Sorry, because it just broke up.
So we had a heli that was waiting for us to take us back to Kathmandu because Nims had like a meeting or something the next day. So we had to go all the way down. And in total from camp 2 to summit, back to base camp took us 32 hours. And that was like probably the worst 32 hours of my life.
Didn't stop you.
But yeah, that's just, we made it, which I'm thankful for because this year there was zero summits on that mountain because the weather was just so terrible. Wow. So we were lucky.
Unbelievable. And do you think that, is that kind of your go-to experience now when things get really hard? You kind of know what you've been through there. You can put yourself there mentally and think, well, actually, this isn't as hard as what I've already done.
Yeah, definitely. And also it was an experience and I learned a lot from it.
Yeah.
For example, learn how to manage your own oxygen, which obviously I did because that was only my third 8,000er in the space of like nothing, 3 months. Yeah. Wow. So I didn't have enough experience. Yeah. And back then, the expedition company that I was with, it was very like full-on nurturing. Like they would tell you when to do everything. They would do everything for you. Like, you're a proper client. Whereas now I'm just, it's me and my climbing partner and we do our own thing. So yeah, I learned from it and, you know, now I know what to do, but obviously
now you're teaching people.
You could have, it could have ended in death, but I was lucky.
Wow. I mean, have you got any aspirations after you complete the 14 peaks or is it very much at the moment your full focus is on there because you seem very driven and looking for the next challenge all the time?
I mean, at the moment, my focus is on that. But I'm always sort of looking ahead a little bit. And hopefully I'd like to start my own expedition company one day, try and go into the sort of the business side of mountaineering. Give myself, my body a break.
And
also just, you know, have time to experience a different side to things and use my brain a little bit because I've lost a few brain cells whilst doing these 8,000ers.
Lack of oxygen.
So yeah, that'd be nice. And also I do a lot of paragliding. So to try and expand on that and maybe fly off some mountains. Let's see. But yeah, and write a book. That'll be
It certainly sounds like you could do that. I mean, what would your advice be? Because you are so young as well, which I think is a huge positive and it's a massive inspirational story. So what would your advice be to someone who just has a dream?
Well, that's the first step, is to actually have a dream. Because most people I meet have no idea what they want to do in life. So before you even find a dream, I would just tell people to say yes to everything they can and to try as many new things as possible. And, you know, I was quite lucky that I found it very quickly. And also my parents were there to kind of push me in that direction. But yeah, just try everything out because you never know. Like I went from ballet to taekwondo to mountaineering and the first two were but then mountaineering was like light bulb moment. So I'd say that. And as soon as you've got that dream, then stick at it. And unfortunately, there's going to be sacrifices. There's going to be a lot of downs. Like, you know, when Everest got cancelled, I was, you know, depressed for a year because everything I'd worked for suddenly just came to an end. And I saw no light at the end of the tunnel, but you keep working at it. I kept training and training, thinking, okay, one day it will happen. So I want to be on top of my game. And then you come out the other side and it's this high that you could never replace in life. And you can carry with you for the rest of your life as well. So if I'm ever feeling, you know, down or upset or anything, I just think, like, how many people in this room have climbed 8,000? It's probably none. So, you know, I have that in my mind and suddenly it motivates me and it keeps me alive and happy. And so, yeah, just keep going and one day you'll achieve that dream and nothing can stop you. Like, not even money, because if you want it that bad, there's ways to get around it and there's ways to work for it. I never thought I would make, you know, $750,000 for this project, but I'm getting there with a lot of hard work.
I get that. Wow. Honestly, Adriana, thank you so much for your time, for coming on Hobby of a Lifetime. It's been an absolute pleasure and really inspirational listening to your story, and all the best with the rest of your challenge.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Hobby of a Lifestyle. Stay safe, stay well, and we'll see you next time.